And in fact, now we're doing something called genomic selection, where we're looking less at individual genes and we're measuring hundreds of different genetic, hundreds and thousands of genetic differences using DNA. And so the increase in rate of progress has probably increased another 10 to 20% with molecular age.
The Swinet Podcast Show Canada is only possible with the support and trust of innovative companies like
DietForge.ai, AI-powered feed formulation with non-linear ingredient modeling and real-time collaboration. Finally, modern software for modern nutritionists. When it comes to 25-hydroxy D3 products, purity matters. Hy-D is a pure, effective 25-hydroxy D3 solution to help pigs improve their vitamin D status. Learn more at hy-d.info. Top Pigs Norsvin, the world's most innovative swine genetics company.
Well, good day. Today I have, my name is Ruud Zijlstra, University of Alberta. A pleasure to be the host of Swinet, a podcast show in Canada focusing on pigs. And today I have with me Dr. Max Rothschild, who is a distinguished professor emeritus at Iowa State University. Welcome, Dr. Rothschild.
Thanks very much.
So it's a pleasure to meet you on this call. And a couple of topics we will cover is, of course, your background, the role of genetics and the use of gene editing. So let's start with your career. What is your background relative to the topic of pig genetics and pig genomics?
Well, thanks very much for having me on today. I got started actually in graduate school working. Well, even before graduate school, I worked with pigs as an undergraduate at UC Davis. And then I also did graduate work with pigs at the University of Wisconsin. I had a couple of jobs in dairy cattle breeding before I got there, and then eventually got to Iowa State University, where my primary work was in pig genetics. And of course, when I started at Iowa State some 46 years ago, we were just basically in the industry getting pigs off the ground and onto concrete and into housing. And there was a big push to start doing test stations and genetic evaluations. And, you know, it really was a big change. Pigs had, as they went to concrete, had all kinds of problems. They had feet and leg problems. Growth rates were different. And so most of my initial work with genetics was quantitative genetics. Basically, we measured pigs for a variety of traits, growth rate, back fat, loin eye area, if we slaughtered some of their offspring. And in the females, we measured litter size, and then we selected the best amongst them. And that over the years changed. In the early 90s, I started doing some work looking at disease resistance and trying to understand a group of genes called the major histocompatibility complex. And then later in the late 90s, we started looking at gene mapping, gene identification, and then eventually doing just molecular genetics work, trying to discover individual genes or groups of genes that affected how pigs grew, had litter sizes, better meat quality, all those things. And we were lucky enough to be quite active there. I was what's called the U.S. Pig Genome Coordinator for a number of years. And in that case, what I did was help my colleagues in the U.S. and around the world to work on gene identification, gene mapping, and look at genetic ways to improve pigs at the DNA level.
Feed formulation software is stuck in the past. Most tools haven't evolved beyond basic least cost optimization. A Diet Forge changes that. It's an AI-powered platform with nonlinear ingredient modeling for enzymes and additives, cost per gain and maximum profit optimization, and real-time collaboration like Google Docs for nutrition. Every recommendation is grounded in world-class research, built for modern nutritionists who need more than legacy desktop software can deliver. Work seamlessly with your team and optimize the way modern operations demand. Try DietForge.ai free today. Feed formulation, finally modernized.
Okay, so then if you would compare the latter stages of your career compared to the first, when you were using quantitative genetics, Have you seen any changes in the increase in rate of production variables when you were using just quantitative genetics versus when now genomics and other fancy tools are being used?
Yeah, so when we started doing most of the quantitative work in the 80s and early 90s, we were making really pretty good progress. And this is the birth of most of the breeding companies that you see out there now. PIC started to come in its heyday, Monsanto Genetics, some of the other companies out there. And sadly, that brought about the demise of most of the seed stock producers. When I started in 1980 in Iowa, 97% of the boars that were sold came from individual seed stock owners. When I retired, probably 1% of the boars came from seed stock. Mm-hmm. So they were making progress, but the show ring in the 80s was a bigger thing than it is now, of course. And so when we started doing molecular genetics, we found a few. The Hallothane gene was a big discovery. The estrogen receptor gene, which I was associated with, was a big discovery. Some of the meat quality genes that my lab discovered, those sped things along. And in fact, now we're doing something called genomic selection, where we're looking less at individual genes and we're measuring hundreds of different genetic, hundreds and thousands of genetic differences using DNA. And so the increase in rate of progress has probably increased another 10 to 20% with molecular age.
And then has that had any effect on when genetic company work, how large of an animal pool they actually need to have in order to supply the pig industry with new genetics? In other words, when you're making a certain selection pressure to perhaps combine with artificial insemination, what kind of role did those two play in order to speed up progress?
Yeah, that's a good question. So normally, as I said, seed stock people sold boars and they used boars for all natural matings. But as time went on and the companies could start to identify better boars more quickly and they wanted to sell more, they started selling more semen. In fact, we've reached a stage now that I won't say giveaway, but price of semen right now is pretty darn cheap. Mm-hmm. So in operations in which the operators are skilled enough to do heat detection and use artificial insemination, we can disseminate genetic progress rather quickly. All the big companies have nucleus herds where the selection occurs. They have multipliers that multiply that genetic progress. And then the multipliers either sell boars or semen or gilts to commercial companies in large numbers to get the production, to get the genetic improvement down to the production level. So there's a what's called a genetic lag. You can't make the selection at the nucleus herd and immediately put it in the commercial herds, but the lag is pretty short. And so things are really moving along at a pretty fast clip right now.
Now, you used two words, genetics and genomics, and then for our audience, how do you separate the two? What is your definition of one versus the other?
Well, genetics, when we talk about genetics in a general sense, we're talking about traits being inherited from parents to offspring. When we talk about genomics, we're still talking about those traits, but we're talking about them at the DNA level, at the absolute level of the gene. So when I say genomics, it has anything to do with how we scan DNA. We genotype animals using DNA chips or other devices, and we use that at that level. So it's at a much finer and more exact level. When we select the best animal, we know that when he passes on those genes, he only gets half of those come to the half of those genes may be are the ones that come from the sire and half come from the dam. So we can't exactly predict. When we look at the DNA of an individual animal, we get a much better idea of what we're selecting.
And then some of the examples that you provided, for example, the Hallothane gene.
Right.
You make a lot of progress there because there were just very few genes involved compared to...
Well, the Hallothane gene was a single gene, which we then learned 15 or 20 years after it was actually... the halothane test was invented by my colleague, Lauren Christian, which basically used halothane to see if the pig had the stress gene or not. And then in 1991, a group of scientists in Canada discovered that it was the rhinodine receptor, and they could identify the individual mutation and they could select against it. What happened and why the gene was in high frequency was that the big push in the late 80s was to get meatier pigs. And this gene in the heterozygous state created pigs that were more muscular. So what we were doing was indirectly, sadly, selecting for the stress allele. Once we had the test, we could get rid of the stress allele and select without it. The estrogen receptor gene, which my group found, we found that one allele in that gene was associated with larger litter size, about two pigs more per litter. And so once we knew we had a genetic test for that, that could be selected and increase litter size much more rapidly than just selecting from big litters.
That's actually interesting because how did that continue into the, let's say, the present 10 years, where continuous progress has been made on litter size? You know, we have now very hyperprolific sows. Are there other genes that then can build on that estrogen gene to get further increases on litter size? That's how that worked?
Absolutely. So there's, I can't guess how many, but there's many genes associated with litter size. Estrogen receptor had the largest single effect of any gene that's been identified, but there were other genes. And so now using genomic selection, in other words, collecting a pool of genes based on that we can associate with better litters of the mothers or their daughters, we can then slowly make changes in the preferred alleles for each of those genes, and that's increased litter size. Of course, with that comes other issues. Maybe the piglets are a little too small, so we have trouble with survival. So many of the companies have, I won't say backed off on litter size, but they put a higher selection pressure now on survivability to 3 days or 5 days or to weaning. And so the selection goal, at least in terms of litter size, is more on survivability than it is total number born.
And when you then focus probably just on the maternal line on some of those litter characteristics, what are then the consequences on the maternal line relative to meat quality and other carcass quality and other such effects? Or can you simply focus on that part on the line of the boar?
Yeah. So what we found over time, and breeders kind of created this indirectly from their work, is that some of the major breeds of pigs, large white or Yorkshire, as we sometimes call them in the U.S. and in North America, and Landrace, those are the so-called mother breeds. And as it turns out, Yorkshire has the estrogen receptor, the preferred allele. None of the other breeds have it unless some of the Yorkshire got into some of the other breeds. They don't have that naturally. And in fact, we can trace that allele, the preferred allele, back to probably this late 1700s in Britain when the British brought in some Chinese pigs. That's where we discovered the estrogen receptor allele. And they used those Chinese pigs in some of their development of their white breeds. Now, on the sire side, there's a reason that Durox and Burks, for instance, have a much higher meat quality. They have a higher frequency of desired alleles that affect meat quality. And that was also found in my lab. We found a gene called PRKA gamma 3, which is associated with water holding capacity in the meat. And it makes a much better pork chop. That's in very high frequency in Berkshires, slightly lower frequency in Durox, almost non-existent in large white and Landrace. Some breeds have been, over time, selected for the characteristics. And, of course, the benefit of all this is the commercial pig is always the result of some cross. So we use the additive effects from the cross of positive traits in the sire lines and positive traits in the dam lines.
And then for genetic selection, what you're indicating is very important, that anything on litter size, we focus on that on the dam, and anything related to meat quality, focus on that for the sire.
That's right. And then we create a crossbred dam, which gets us what's called heterosis or hybrid vigor, and we do even a little better. So a crossbred dam, sometimes pure sires, sometimes we're using crossbred sires to also get heterosis for some of the male traits.
Now, you mentioned something very interesting about Yorkshire, and perhaps some gene came over from East Asia or China a long time ago.
Right.
Can you actually detect that via modern technologies, how some of those genes went around the world?
Well, we can detect them. What we do know in the case of the estrogen receptor is that the only breed of the major breeds that has the so-called B allele, which is the preferred allele, that's only in large white in Yorkshire.
Yep.
Well, I shouldn't say only. It's been seen in a few landrace, but it's a bit suspect how it got there.
Yep.
And we know historically that the British brought in Chinese breeds at the same time in the late 1700s in the formation of some of these. But we can look at using both historical information and DNA from breeds to see how they're actually related, using the molecular genetics to do that.
Yeah, so in other words, the written or the oral history matched with what you can find from at the DNA level.
Right, and that's not all that different than when people trace their own genealogy, if you like.
Yep.
Many people 20 years ago never used DNA. They went, found birth records, they found death records, they traced all that. Now you can go to one of the companies that's out there, get your DNA, and all of a sudden it says you've got 1,000 relatives you never knew you had. Well, that's perhaps not exactly true. Some of those just have the same DNA by chance, but some could be related. I've done it. I was a part owner in a company for a while, and it's always pleasant to find that a couple of your second cousins have tried their DNA, and just as expected, they show up.
Now, of course, more recent, a hot topic has become gene editing. So how does that, when you then follow genomics, what role does gene editing then have to make further progress for the pork industry?
That's a great question. So to do gene editing, you need to have a target gene. You need to know something about this gene affects some trait. And so at the back end of the front end of the process, is somebody has to identify this gene is associated with this trait. And then once they do that, they can look for mutations that affect it. Well, generally, those mutations are in very, very, very low frequency. So it's almost impossible to breed them back into the population. So if you can perform gene editing, which is essentially like taking a little molecular scissors, if you like, cutting the DNA and either inserting something or removing something, and that way you alter the DNA and get the trait you want. And then that animal can then be a breeder for the next generations. And unlike the old transgenics where they just shoved in DNA any place, this is very precise. You're identified a particular site. You're using pig DNA to alter pig DNA. So we say genomic editing, genome editing, but it's extremely precise. It's nothing like transgenics used to be, and it has enormous potential if the public will accept that they and buy animals that are produced either for a second or third or fourth generation from genome editing.
In other words, it still means researchers need to do their homework linking genes to particular outcomes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the hottest one right now is PRRS resistance, which one of the companies, PIC, Genus, the parent company, it was identified in a lab in Scotland what gene was involved. They produced gene-edited pigs. They've done enormous amounts of testing to make sure that, A, It is resistant to PRRS, and B, C, and D, it's healthy. It doesn't change anything else. The meat quality is the same. There's no health risks to humans. And then, of course, there's all the hurdles to get it approved for human consumption.
Which happened in the States and also recently in Canada. Yep.
Yeah, but the real question is, will the consumer accept that?
Yep, completely. And
it's just not clear yet. Most consumers accept genetically modified plants, but it's not clear they will with animals yet.
So when you then look at PRRS resistance, does that then also mean some resistance to other similar diseases? Or do you need to look at other genes for other diseases in order to have similar effects?
Yeah, I don't know if there are any other diseases that this PRRS edited pig is resistant to. But as a general notion, because of the very exact nature of this, it's important to identify which genes are associated with particular diseases. Now, you could see the opportunity to perhaps edit genes that have a more general resistance. But in this case, but you have to identify those just and for the most part, there's still plenty of work to be done in that area. The other one that's come out now recently is gene editing so that you produce males without testicles. Well, you produce pigs where no testicles are involved so that you basically don't have to worry about boar taint. But again, it's not been, not enough post-experimental testing has been done to verify that that's all well and good.
And then on the comments you made about PRRS resistance, does that then mean 100% resistance?
It appears to be so, yes.
And of course, there's different types of PRRS, if I recall. So did they?
Yeah, I can't answer that completely. But to my knowledge, it appears to be PRRS resistant. There's different strains of PRRS.
Yeah, that's what I meant. Sorry.
But to my knowledge, it appears to be resistant to all of them. And that really serves, and one of the selling points is that you lower disease issues on the farm, then it's much higher pig welfare, and that's extremely important.
Yep, I would agree with that comment. So you mentioned the consumers. So any insights on how the consumers in the U.S. look at this gene-edited pig?
I hesitate to stick my neck out on this one. Like I say, you can tell a person that cattle have eaten GMO crops in the gazillion numbers of cattle have eaten them, and there's no negative effect on the cattle or the people that ate the cattle. And yet there are people that say, I don't want any animal that's been fed GMO products. And you can go a step further, and they'll say something like, I don't want an animal that's been fed DNA.
Yep.
Wait a second.
Yeah,
everything is made of DNA. You eat DNA. Milk is DNA. They all contain DNA. Logic doesn't seem to take over in most of these cases of people that are extremely negative about these things.
So then one of the reasons that gene editing then seems to work, like you identified, it's associated with a particular trait. And likely only a small quantity or a small amount of genes need to be changed in order to get that change in the trait. So does that limit gene editing to certain traits, or can all traits be changed using gene editing?
I think eventually most traits will be able to be improved by gene editing. But it still goes that you need to have target genes identified first.
Yep, exactly.
So, for instance, in some meat quality or others, there's some target genes that have been identified, and they could be modified. They can also be improved by strictly normal selection techniques, because in many of these cases, those genes are in relatively high frequency. In the PRRS case, the gene and the form of the gene that confers resistance was in very, very low frequency. So the only way to get it in higher frequency was to produce gene-edited pigs.
And of course, PRRS is an unfortunately an important disease for pork production. So
it is, and vaccines have not been effective, and just general selection has been not effective, and sadly even biosecurity methods, and there are some very good ones out there, they sometimes break.
Interesting. Are there any other traits similar to PRRS and no testes like you identified that might be a potential target for gene editing in the near future?
I haven't heard of any recently. In other species, there's a big push to produce cattle without horns, for an example. That's one of the big ones that's out there. To produce cattle that have certain milk characteristics, that's out there. I think scientists are attempting to find all these genes as targets. The companies, of course, are concerned about acceptance. So everybody's pushing, but with a certainly a bit of caution.
And of course, we also need to think about our export markets, certainly in states and Canada.
Exactly.
On top of the local, the domestic consumer.
That's exactly right. And so scientists have a big sales job, and this is in an era, I don't know about Canada, but in the U.S. here, we're sadly in an era of anti-science, less vaccinations, less listening to scientists, more listening to quacks. It's very problematic.
Now, if a person would like to know a little bit more about genetics and genomics, is there a particular resource that you recommend where people could read or follow?
Well, the best book for pigs is The Genetics of the Pig. It's a second volume now. It has a number of chapters, each dealing with different traits, and it's a very good resource. I'm one of the editors of the book. It's a bit old. We're starting to work on the third edition, and sadly, one of the co-authors died. So we haven't progressed, but that's a wealth of information that would give a great background about genetics of the pig.
Excellent. Well, I thank you much for this conversation, Dr. Rothschild. It's good information for our audience. So this concludes another episode of the Swinet Podcast Show Canada. And thank you for joining today.
Thank you very much for asking me to participate. I appreciate that.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent without a time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on your $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.